Great. House Committee on Revenue for April 17, 2009 will come to order. Colleagues, I apologize for starting so late this morning, but we seem to be working on a whole number of bills at the same time, and we're going to open a public hearing on H.J.R. 7. You'll recall that H.J.R. 7 is a constitutional amendment having to do with changes that have been proposed in the Oregon War Veterans Fund. And we don't have anyone signed up to testify, do we?
We have the Veterans Affairs. We asked them to.
Okay, we have Veterans Affairs here. We have also received a couple of letters from Mr. Willis. Yes, Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, since we don't have any witnesses, I'll just say, you know, good bill should pass.
Yeah. We raised some issues around the administration of the fund that are tangential to this resolution. They don't really directly address the resolution as such. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on H.J.R. 7. And colleagues will open a work session on H.J.R. 7. This has a subsequent referral, doesn't it? To rules.
To rules, that's right.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. January 12th.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Riley.
I move House Joint Resolution 7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent to rules.
Thank you. Representative Riley moves House Joint Resolution 7 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation and with a subsequent referral to the Rules Committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to this resolution going to rules? I don't see any. With that, the motion is carried. Resolution goes to rules. Thank you. We'll close the work session on H.J.R. 7 and open a work session on House Bill 2970. who's on that one? Oh, do we not have, we're not ready on that one?
We are ready. Chris is down making
copies. Oh, well, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2970, you have a dash 2 amendment, which was discussed by Representative Nathanson when she was here initially on the public hearing. And what that does is it just clarifies who is involved in terms of the bill is designed to encourage the use of the earned income tax credit. And what the amendment does is clarify who is responsible for that. Director of the Housing and Community Services Department, for example, convenes an interdepartmental work group for the purpose of expanding the number of eligible. What you also have in front of you is a revenue impact statement that Chris has prepared for you, and also a fiscal impact statement. On the revenue impact statement, we didn't feel that we could quantify a specific number. If the outreach efforts are successful, then there should be some increase in federal refundable credits available to Oregon residents. That would have a feedback. 6% of whatever the increase is to the federal EITC would be eligible for an Oregon EITC. I see Chris is here, so
okay.
I'll turn it over to him.
All right. Thank you. Colleagues, you'll recall this bill was brought to us by Representative Nathanson. We held a hearing only 10 days ago. And this bill, if we send it out, will go to the floor. Is there any discussion?
Are we in work session?
We are, yes.
No, go ahead.
Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move that dash 2 dated 4-6-2009 to House Bill 2970.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2970. Discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'm not wild about task forces and work groups. however, if the departments involved think they can do this within their existing budgets, I think it's a good idea for them to do so. I'm not sure why we need a statute to do that, but it's fine.
Okay.
Not sure why they couldn't do that without a statute. But I am not going to object to the bill.
Thank you.
I've got a bigger problem. My computer doesn't work.
This amendment replaces everything except the last section in the bill, doesn't it?
Okay.
I believe that's correct. They find a copy of the original bill.
Yeah, the original bill has a blank for appropriations in line 20, but I think that that's been deleted by the changes. So in effect, this bill doesn't contain an appropriation, and so it doesn't need to go to Ways and Means. If we adopt the dash 2. And that motion's been made, yes. Is there any objection to the dash 2? I don't see any. With that, the dash 2 is adopted. Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2970 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves House Bill 2970 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection to this bill going to the floor? All right, the motion is carried. The bill goes to the floor. I will ask Representative Nathanson if she would like to carry this bill. I don't see her this morning, so we'll inquire. He's coming at 9 o'clock. All right. All right. Colleagues, I want to let you know that... and we'll close the work session, on 2970. Colleagues, I want to let you know that we're not ready to work House Bill 2105. Is there a time you want that moved over to, Paul? Tuesday. We will hold the work session on 2105 on Tuesday, and hopefully it will be ready then. So that goes over to Tuesday. We need a fiscal report on the amendments on House Bill 2068. Will that be ready on Tuesday? We do need to talk about it. Okay.
The dash 4 is the one.
All right. So we'll open the work session on House Bill 2068. Chris, is that yours?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you recall last week there was a dash 1 through dash 3, and new in your packet it now is a dash 4, which is a modified version of the dash 3. And the policy here is to provide some guidance to the Department of Energy to update their discount price for the transfer of a credit to a quarterly update. So what the Dash 4 does is grant energy rulemaking authority to establish the formula through the rulemaking process. So once a year or so, they would establish the formula that incorporates inflation projections and market real rate of return. So they would have that formula established, and then quarterly they would be able to provide updated inputs into that formula. So the formula itself would not change every quarter, just the inputs into that formula. For example, inflation projections. As you know, we're experiencing a time where these things are changing rather rapidly. So on a quarterly basis, new inflation projections could be put into the established formula, as well as expectations for market rate of returns into that formula. So that would update on a quarterly basis the discount price for the transfer of the credit.
Thank you. Representative Benz, did you want to comment on this proposal?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Only that this is a result of numerous meetings, numerous discussions, and finally a decision to stick with what the department had been doing, only increasing the number of times from two times a year to four, to try to get a more refined means of establishing the price of the discount. It's still obviously not a market device, but the trade-off was a large mechanism for establishing market as opposed to this formula, and we decided to stick with the formula.
Thank you. I think that what we might do, this amendment really is a punt on the original bill, and I think it's because we worked at it and realized that we weren't going to get it done. Rather than try to struggle through and pass something that might be worse than what we have now, we decided to simply refine the pricing mechanism a little bit. That's what the Dash 4 does, is it not? And it is my hope that we will continue working in the interim on the larger issue of how we handle transferences. But this leaves the rule basically intact, except for the pricing, except for making pricing a bit more flexible. So it's likely to reflect current conditions more readily. And you consulted with the department in the drafting of the Dash 4.
Yes.
And I'm getting a head nod from Mr. Graney. Okay. All right, good. Colleagues, we don't have the fiscal on this one, on the Dash 4, so we can't move the bill today. Will we have that on Monday? I mean, on Tuesday?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The committee had discussed the Dash 1, the Dash 2, and Dash 4. We don't have a fiscal on any of the Dash amendments.
Okay.
So in terms of the cleanest way for the paperwork would be if it suits the committee to put together a combined amendment of the Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 4, and then get the paperwork on that amendment. If the committee...
Okay. Would you describe the 1 and 2 for us again?
Sure. The Dash 1 and Dash 2 are just a codification of the interpretation of statute by Energy and Revenue. And the Dash 1 says that a transferee may only be a C corporation, an S corporation, or a personal income taxpayer. That's the way Energy and Revenue have interpreted existing statute. So this is just a codification of that interpretation. There's no change in the administration of these credits. The Dash 2 is similar with respect to it being a codification of the interpretation of the existing statute. And what the Dash 2 does is says that when the legislature says a credit may be transferred, it may only be transferred once.
Right. And 4 we've already discussed.
4 you've just discussed about the formula for updating the discount price.
All right. And I think it would be appropriate to have a combination motion that basically says that we want the substance of all three of these in the bill. Because otherwise they're all gut and stuffs of each of, and the last one would be the one we do. Am I right about that, or do I need to do it a different way?
If the committee wants to move in the direction of the Dash 1, all three of those, the Legislative Council would draft a combined amendment to that effect. in terms of, it's a paperwork issue in that to get a fiscal on all three of them individually, it's a workload issue.
Yes.
And if the committee would like to adopt all three of them, then we can get a combined amendment and then just do the paperwork once rather than three times on those policies. But it depends on the committee's pleasure, if the committee wants to adopt all three of those.
All right. Well, let me get a straw. So you're suggesting that we would ask Ledge Council to draft a fifth amendment that would combine the one, two, and four?
Exactly.
All right. Okay. What's your pleasure, committee? Would you give me a sense as to whether you want to adopt these three amendments, and will I ask fiscal to draft a dash five that does that? Yes,
Mr. Chair, can I ask Representative Benz? He did the work group on
this.
Yes,
he did. Yes.
And I guess I would be guided by his thoughts on these three amendments.
I would support the combination of one, two, and four into one amendment, just as Chris has suggested.
Yeah, I have to admit that I haven't done the detail work on this, but I would be guided by somebody who does.
Yeah, the only real substantive change is the dash four,
yeah.
But the other two make it clear that the existing way they're handling these things is correct.
Exactly. That was my understanding. Now that my
yes,
computer's up
Benz.
And going, I've got my notes.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add, there was a lot of work put in by Mr. Alanak and others in trying to advance beyond where we are, but the cost of doing so, I don't think would be supported by Ways and Means, and the time it takes to create the device would be really significant. I'm not particularly happy with this result, but it's the best we could do given those constraints.
Thank you. I agree with that, all of those comments. I think they're all accurate. Okay, well, I think you have your instructions then. We'll prepare a dash five that combines the three and ask fiscal for a fiscal on that amendment. All right, is that clear? Do I have anybody concerned about that? Okay. All right. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2068. And we need to carry. Well, we will reopen the work session on Tuesday if we have that amendment. But we'll put it on the agenda for Tuesday for House Bill 2068 for another work session. All right. All right, now we have back to our perennial favorite, the one that seems to be getting fatter and fatter. I wondered why we had these big files to carry bills around in, and this bill is reminding me of that, and that's House Bill 2472. So we'll open the work session on 2472. And colleagues, I think we have a number of new amendments. As if you hadn't known that.
That's not right.
Chris?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you have, there's a dash 18, dash 19, and dash 20. Dash 18 is in your packet, and we were making copies of the dash 19 and dash 20. And I think you're about to receive those. So what the dash 18 amendment does is it removes gasoline electric hybrid vehicles from the definition of alternative fuel vehicle.
We have 19 and 20.
19 and 20, okay.
Okay. All right. The only thing 18 does is remove hybrid electric gasoline electric?
I believe so, Mr. Chair. I can't find any other changes in here.
But is it also a gut and stuff? No, not quite.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Representative
Bailey.
Without speaking for any other representative, I might shed a little bit of light, I think,
please,
where the dash 18s came from. For those of us on the Transportation Committee who might also care to, to correct me if I'm wrong here, we heard a bill in the Transportation Committee that was Representative Nathanson's bill on relating to plug-in electric vehicles and tax credits for it. And there was an intention, I believe, without speaking to her intent too much, in that bill to include a deletion of the hybrid tax credit in order to offset some of the costs of that particular bill. However, there was not an ability under the relating clause to do that in that other bill, which will be coming to this committee. And so instead, an amendment was submitted to the Betsy to delete the hybrid credit. Colleagues on the Transportation Committee, am I remembering that correctly?
Yes.
How many are on the Transportation
Committee? There are four of us.
Four of you. Okay. All right. So we have good representation there. Mm-hmm. All right. Good.
Wonder how that happened, Mr.
Chair. Some of it is simply an artifact of when committee times are. Once you get on this committee, that dictates what other committees you can serve on.
Does anybody else meet at 8 a.m.? I'm sorry.
No, there's only a few slave drivers in the building. So the point of this is simply to remember. Now, did you have testimony in transportation on the issue of gasoline electric hybrid vehicles and the need for a tax credit on those?
I don't think so, Mr. Chair. We had testimony on the bill relating to plug-in electric vehicles, but not on the concept of the deletion of the gasoline electric hybrid tax credit.
Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you just look outside, you'll see that the credit's no longer needed.
Happen to agree with Representative Riley.
Are we idiots, sir?
No, he said I should look outside. Oh. I think he's right. Yes, thank you. All right.
In a general sense.
Now, we have two additional amendments. Let's talk about those two.
I'm still reading through these, but I believe the Dash 19 is identical to the Dash 9 with one change. And that change, if you're looking on the Dash 19 on line 20, if you recall, this subsection 3 refers to other criteria that energy may consider in determining pre-certs. So that the language that's different there on line 20, it says the department may consider issuing. Now, on the Dash 9, the existing language refers to the department may decline to issue. So I believe those are the two-word changes.
Yep. Representative Berger.
Yes. I have discussed this with Director Graney. He agrees that this is better language than the may decline is may consider issuing instead of may decline to issue. It's a sort of a different tone and gives him consideration approval and not just declining approval.
All right. Otherwise, this does the same thing.
Otherwise, it is designed to be as Dash 9. Okay.
Similar to Dash 9.
Okay. Mr. Chair, does this substantively change the power of Mr. Graney's power with regards to accepting or declining an application?
I don't think it does, but some other people were concerned about it. Did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I have a real concern. May decline as may consider it. I think it gives them a little more flexibility in what they're doing when they get these pre-certs. And I think it is better language. It's my amendment, so I think it matters, or I wouldn't have brought it to you, Representative Call.
I'm just trying to Representative Berger, I'm agnostic as to the language itself. I'm just trying to understand if it does something different because I can't understand that it does.
It gives a little more flexibility. This is tough stuff.
No,
it's tough. I'll tell you, when you get to the agency level too, and these words will matter. And I think may decline was just a sort of a stop here, and may consider issuing gives them a little wiggle room that I think will be useful. Because these projects don't come, if I could expound, Mr. Chair, in easy, neat packages tied up with a bow that all the bells and whistles are exactly comparable and the apples and the oranges, and I think that the agency has to make some important decisions here, and I just think this language is a little clear that they have a little flexibility in here.
And the dash 20? Dash 20 makes some other very substantive changes. It has the may consider, and as I'm reading through it, if you flip to page 7, it modifies the caps, and it changes, it deletes the $20 million category for the renewable energy resources. It leaves the $40 million cap for the solar world, so to speak, in place, and then changes the $10 million to $15 million. So in effect, that creates two categories for the cap. Rather than a 10, 20, and 40, we go to a 15 and a 40.
Oh, I see. Is that like the dash 11? Except for the may consider?
It's different. The dash 11 literally just changed the 20 to a 15, so it only applied to those renewable energy resource.
Okay.
The renewables. This would change the 10, which applies to all other projects, to the 15. And I haven't had a chance yet to talk to my granny about whether the effect that might be on all the other projects that are out there, and whether any of them actually have hit that cap, because there are many other projects that are very small.
Mr. Granny, do you want to be heard on that topic?
Isn't there a sunset in here, too?
There does appear to be.
In the dash 20?
Yeah.
I believe section 10, on page 16, section 10, it says it takes effect on January 1, 2011. Or what those amendments?
Yes,
I haven't read that.
And what it does is reverse the amendment.
Really? Right. Is that what those sections do?
Yeah. Section 5 reverses the amendment.
That's how they did the sunset. Right.
So what it is this new limit is in effect until the end of 2010, and then the old limit is restored.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Mike Graney from Department of Energy. That's correct. It effectively creates a sunset of January 1st, 2011 on the reduction from $20 million to $15 million. And did you want me to talk about the size of projects in terms of dollar amounts, in terms of wind farms?
Well, not just wind farms, because this particular amendment changes the cap for everything else.
Yes,
15.
Sure. That's correct.
And that would not just be wind farms, but I assume that would include conservation projects and everything.
And Mr. Chair,
except for manufacturing.
Yes.
Yes. What I was trying to get at is some of the biomass.
Yes.
And those kinds of projects that I want in here that are getting bigger. Bigger, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that is correct. Most of the large projects have been wind, but we have had some biomass, and they would have been affected by the $20 million to $10 million reduction as well, because that would have applied to everything that's not manufacturing. And we do have an occasional large energy efficiency project that's that large. Those are pretty rare, but it's principally wind and, to a lesser extent, biomass and industrial cogeneration that would be affected. And we've estimated, using the numbers before, or the baseline methodology before, where by going from $20 million to $10 million, you would have saved about $16 million for the next biennium, that this option saves about half. We came up with $7.91 million in our estimate yesterday. So, and that, you know, is sort of intuitive what you would think, too, by reducing the reduction by half. Representative Bensett also asked for some information yesterday on the specific wind farm project size that we have in terms of dollar costs. I have that information for you. The again, going back, we had 23 projects in 2008 that were $5 million or more of all types, and that constituted 78% of the revenue impact. That's sort of the basis for our analysis of revenue reductions. In 2008, we approved final certifications, gave tax credits for five wind projects that were greater than $5 million. And all of those were over 50 megawatts, so those were all quite large. This year, so far, we haven't had any final certificates. We have issued four preliminary certifications. Those were all under 20 megawatts each. Those were smaller. And for projects pending, we have 10 wind projects pending, five of which are over 25 megawatts. In fact, five of them are quite large. They're 150 megawatts or larger. Five are under 25 megawatts. In fact, they're very small. They're 1 megawatt or less. So we do see a mixture. We're kind of seeing extremes this year of very large and very small. And it takes about a 5-megawatt facility to get you up to $10 million in terms of the project cost. So I think we're going to continue to see a combination of large and small wind projects.
Thank you. And I assume that on the very large projects, the Betsy is a less significant portion of the financing. Simply because that number gets smaller and smaller as a proportion of the entire project.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. The developers tell us it's certainly a factor, but proportionally it's much smaller than for the smaller. It is smaller proportionately than for the smaller size projects.
Right. Other questions for Mr. Graney?
Mr. Chairman, could I address the Dash 18?
Please, go ahead, yes. As long as you're there, tell us what you think.
Well, yeah. And I haven't seen this language before, but I guess as it's drafted, I would be a little concerned that it says alternative fuel vehicle does not mean a gasoline electric hybrid vehicle. And I know what we have in mind. We're talking about the Priuses and the Hondas that are out there on the street right now. But the new plug-in hybrids, such as the ones that were being demonstrated last week in Oregon with three different companies, those technically are also gasoline hybrid because they do use gasoline for various percentages depending on what the driving is. That's part of what extends the mileage. So I think we need a more precise term, or what's in House Bill 2180 that passed out of Representative Reed's committee last week has language that's based on the efficiency that would give us the ability to scale down the tax credit for the vehicles that are being purchased right now and increase the tax credit for the plug-in hybrids and others that will be pure electric vehicles.
Thank you, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put on the record, and this is an uncomfortable thing to do, but given where we're at in our economy right now, it's very hard for me to support tax credits for people to buy new cars. When we have people who are trying to figure out how to pay their bills, how to keep their heat on, how to feed their kids, how to go to college, people that have the money to go and buy a new car, no matter how cool the new gadget is and how much we want to encourage people to do those things, I don't see that as a budget priority in this session. So I am not interested in scaling back and giving an incentive to buy new cars, no matter how nifty they might be. We simply can't afford to do that right now when people are going to do it anyway.
Thank you. And I assume that means that you would support measures like the Dash 18.
Yes.
Which reduce the kinds of vehicles that these credits apply to.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, Representative Call, and then yeah, Representative Berger.
Yeah, and just to, since some of us sit on transportation, just for the record so that we know what Representative Nathanson's tax credit does, is it only gives a tax credit to consumers who purchase electric cars made in Oregon. So it's I think actually coupling these two things together, which is removing a tax credit that is utilized to purchase cars that are produced overseas or outside of our state, and trading that off with a tax credit that not immediately but probably 2, 3, 4 years down the road is going to be utilized by people once our economy turns around to purchase cars that are produced in our state. That's the fullness of the policy debate. And you, being privy to that in the Transportation Committee, wanted to share those thoughts here. Not to take umbrage with anything you said. I completely agree. I just don't think that right now instituting the electric car tax credit for cars produced in Oregon is going to be much of an immediate impact on current tax revenues.
And it may increase the likelihood of us getting a manufacturing facility here.
Well, considering you can only use the credit if the car is produced here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And I appreciate that, but I have not been convinced of really how many jobs that's creating. People that are interested in buying electric cars are interested in buying electric cars. They can do it without a tax credit. We have so many difficult decisions we are making this session. We have so many vital services that we're going to be reducing. We have all sorts of tax credits that we're seeing here that help people in their homes, in their houses, and to do the basics of daily living. And I don't see hybrid cars, electric cars, as a basic essential moving forward. And as I've heard others say, they're taking hard lines on tax credits. Tax credits for new cars, no matter how neat and good they might be, that's a really hard sell for me.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
I think the discussion is the one that I was encouraging.
Thank you.
Representative Call made my points.
Thank you. So, Representative Call, let me ask so that I understand. It sounds like there's another bill in another committee that deals with a piece of this issue.
Yeah, so like Representative Bailey was saying.
It has been moved to this committee.
It's coming to this committee. And so what Representative Bailey was referring to earlier was that we would be removing this tax credit for hybrid cars to counterbalance the creation of a new tax credit by through a piece of legislation proposed by Representative Nathanson that would give, I can't remember the dollar amount, but a tax credit for the purchase of electric vehicles that are produced in the state of Oregon.
Okay. And is there any reason why this issue can't be addressed in that bill?
The relating clause is inadequate.
Oh, that's the problem. Okay. All right. Representative Berger.
And, Mr. Chair, with regard to that bill is a tax credit to the purchaser, and the Betsy is a tax credit to the manufacturer. And I just philosophically stand with my colleague here in terms of where I want the tax credit to go. It's the jobs that I want, so it's the manufacturing that, and if it's a good product, then we'll buy it, okay, without a tax credit. So I guess I'm, but what I really want to see is what is coming out of Representative Reed's committee, which is a way of defining these vehicles based on performance, not on what, and that's what I'm hopeful that we can get to, the definition of saying this is a good vehicle because it does these performance things, not because it's called a hybrid or called an electric or has these things in it. And that's what I really think we need to get to.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson, thank you for joining us this morning. I assume you have something to say about this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It is a little challenging to deal with an objective which requires discussing two different bills to achieve the desired outcome. The objective of House Bill 3253 is to provide a tax credit for electric vehicles, and as Representative Call pointed out, exchange credits that we're currently giving for hybrid to be able to pay for tax credits for electric. It was necessary to address it in two different bills. I think it's important important to note that electric vehicles are much less expensive to operate for consumers. In the testimony that I provided to the Transportation Committee, I had figures citing up to $2,000 less a year for operations and maintenance of an electric vehicle because of the kind of engine that's in it, because of the kind of drive it is. It's not only the difference in fuel, it's the difference in the operating and maintenance expenses. It's because of the kind of technology that's used to run the vehicle. So it is less expensive for the consumer. So I think it's not only a car for the future to encourage for cleaner air and reducing our dependence on foreign oil, for example, it's also a very consumer-oriented product for working people to be able to make that choice. And with regard to whether a credit should go to consumers or to producers, that's something that is a good one for this committee to discuss. I believe that it's important to provide the credit for the people who would be using the product, then they can make their choice of which of the product options there are to purchase. The consumer has the choice, but without an adequate market, then the companies that would want to be doing business in Oregon and want to expand their production, such as the new companies, the startup companies that we already have developing these vehicles in Oregon, it's harder for them to be able to ramp up to a scale where the economies start bringing the price down. So that's what you do in the startup of a new kind of industry. There is usually some support, and I think it's a good idea to provide, in this kind of economy, to provide the support for the consumers, which then does create the kind of business environment so these new businesses can survive and expand.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
They get us confused all the time.
No, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make the comment because I made some pretty bold comments about this. I have to get up to leave for a meeting with the speaker. I'm not leaving because I object to the testimony. So I apologize.
You should be aware that the speaker, that our information is that the speaker will be here at 9 o'clock to talk about another bill.
Yes, yes.
So,
he's pretty magical.
He is magical. He can be in both two places at once, but that's what I'm told, is that he will be here at 9 o'clock.
Well, if he's here, I will be back.
Yeah, I suspect you will. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Forgive me, Representative Nathanson. I can't remember all of the contours of your bill. Wasn't there also a stipulation in the bill that it was up to a certain number of cars, and then the tax credit would no longer be in existence? So this really is about starting up the industry, and once it has its wings under it, letting it go. Am I remembering that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Call, excuse me, I forgot to state my name and district for the record when I responded first time. I'm Nancy Nathanson. I represent House District 13. In that bill, first, there is a sunset date in an amendment, so that it in a way addresses some of your comment. Also, there is a provision that this would apply to tax credits for up to 5 vehicles. So, for example, if a business wanted to start replacing its fleet, let's say an in-town courier service, it could be used for up to 5 vehicles, but not more than that.
Thank you.
Again, in an effort to show that I'm... the objective is to help, but to be modest in its support and trying to be consumer-focused.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nathanson, thank you for coming down. I'm looking forward to having a more thorough discussion of your bill when we have it before the committee, and probably a lot of these points will come up again. Getting back to the particular, the Dash 18 on the deletion, I was given... Am I understanding correct that the Dash 18, that you helped craft that Dash 18 amendment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bailey, in a way, yes, I expressed my intent to Legislative Council, and in a very big hurry under the tremendous strain of what goes down in Legislative Council, this is their best effort, and I think it does address the objective that I was trying to meet. I understand from some discussion I heard previously that it may be in conflict with some of the vehicles that are produced, and so other amendments may be requested by this committee.
Well, yeah, go ahead and get the specific question. Yeah,
and that leads right into my discussion, into my question about intent. So just so we're clear on the Dash 18 as a committee, as we consider it and we consider Director Greeney's comments, as it's written, it applies to both parallel hybrids and sequential hybrids, where you have to plug in the hybrid, where you have an electric engine that runs, finishes running, and then a gas, like the Chevy Volt, where and then the gas power takes over to extend the range of the electric. And my understanding of how it's written is it applies to both that as well as a Toyota Prius, which operates a electric motor and a gasoline motor simultaneously to complement each other. And so was it your intent in drafting this amendment to have it apply to both of these kinds of hybrid vehicles, or did you have one or the other in mind?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bailey, yes, my intent was to apply to any kind of hybrid technology, feeling that hybrid technology is pretty well established now, and to shift our focus to an emerging industry, which is electric. However, I do understand the tension that might be created around that, and I've just received an education beyond what I could have discussed myself, the parallel and sequential difference between those two, and it really is a different vehicle, but it was my intent to help a new and emerging market.
Thank you, Representative. I think it's very helpful for this committee as we consider the Dash 18s to know what the intents were, and that's very clear. Thank you.
Representative Reed, you've been sitting there very patiently. I think you have something else to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tobias Reed, State Representative, District 27. When I was first entering the legislature, I wanted to be on the Revenue Committee for a lot of reasons. One that I didn't fully appreciate at the time, but continue to develop new appreciation for, is how the Revenue Committee is at the center of everything, and everything seems to come here. Okay. That's more evident.
Unless today. It goes to Ways and Means.
Well, it comes here first. A lot of time. So, talking about 2472, we're talking about Representative Nathanson's bill, and I've heard some general comments about another bill that came from our committee, Sustainability and Economic Development. Vice Chair Benson and Vice Chair Bailey are on that committee as well, so they know something about this. But all I really wanted to point out was that I think there are a couple of, at least a couple of elements that have already been mentioned, both for the manufacturer and for the consumer of these kinds of products. I think it's entirely appropriate that the policy elements are discussed in the Sustainability and Economic Development and Transportation Committees and then come here for the revenue implications. I think the thing that most excites me about House Bill 2180 that is on its way to the Revenue Committee, if it's not already here, is the ability for the department to respond quickly to market conditions, to adjust response to people's preferences and activities. And I think as we try to support and encourage the manufacturing and use of alternative vehicles, it makes sense for us to be considering both the manufacturer and the consumer.
Thank you. I don't want to pre-consider that bill, so I think that's probably enough on that one today. But I really very much appreciate, Representative Nathanson, your clarification of this language. This language appears to be exactly what you had in mind. Thank you. Okay. Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is probably for Director Graney, but it goes to what we were trying to do and accomplish with 2472, which was to kind of tighten down the device. And the question is, it goes to this Dash 18 amendment, how much of an impact is this going to have on the money that we've been spending for this tax credit? In other words, and you may have given us this information earlier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pence, I would have to go back and look. We didn't do a revenue impact on this amendment this morning. Because I didn't realize this one was coming. But the alternative fuel vehicles, are a pretty small proportion of the business energy tax credit. So I think I don't think there would be a significant revenue impact on this part. But I think given the technical wording of the language, it does go into conflict with the provisions that you had about electric vehicle manufacturing. That is in there. That we're adding provisions for electric vehicle manufacturing, but those electric vehicles, in fact, at this time at least, are mostly plug-in hybrids, which this language in dash 18 conflicts with. So I think there's a policy and a technical issue there as to how broad you make the prohibition on hybrid vehicles. And I do agree that we don't need the incentives for the hybrid vehicles that we see commonly on the streets now. But under current law, we can't affect that.
It sounds to me as though we're going to have a look at 2180 before we finish this one at this stage in order to know exactly what we want in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I do think that, if I recall correctly, the relating clause for House Bill 2180 is very broad. I think you'd be able to address, I think it's broader than Representative Nathanson's bill, the relating clause, so that I think you'd be able to address the issues there.
Relating to energy, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, let me restate what I already stated before, because I want to be really clear. In the Betsy, we are trying to encourage the manufacture of alternative energy in some way within our state. And so the growth of the car, whether it be all electric or hybrid, if they are manufactured in our state, I don't care quite how they're manufactured, sequentially, parallel, or whatever. It's the manufacturing that I'm interested in here. And so while we may be wordsmithing this, in the Betsy, we're talking about things made here and encouraging that. So I don't want to narrow this down here and get too tight on what we're making. But I will restate my objection to giving a tax credit to the purchaser because the market should determine whether the vehicle is good or not. But let's get them trying to make them here, and then I think we'll all rush out and buy our Oregon-made car.
Thank you. The comment I would have on that issue, of course, is the one that, to restate what Representative Nathanson said, is that sometimes you may have to guarantee a market in order to get the manufacturing here in the first place. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that comment was that you don't go along with the dash 18. You don't.
Right.
And I agree with that. For different reasons, but some of the same reasons and some different reasons. I think it's misplaced. I don't think, frankly, it belongs in this bill because we are trying to encourage all those issues. And if there is another spot for it, like Representative Reed's bill, which seems to be perhaps a better spot for it, I don't like that amendment in this bill.
Thank you. That's helpful. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all due respect, I think the concept behind the Dash 18, I think, is a sound one.
Yeah.
And I think we can have some debates about this committee on where the best place to do that is, but I do think that the concept is very sound. The one distinction that I would hope to make is to think about, if we're talking about the Betsy, in which we have a credit that is both for manufacture as well as for the creation and generation of renewable energy and for energy savings, that we also take into account that some of these kinds of vehicles, depending on how they're manufactured and what the technology is, can be used as part of the grid system and can feed energy back into the grid and can be a storage device for alternative energies as well. So it's not just about the transportation component. There's also a grid component to these vehicles, and I'd hope that we would consider that as we're looking at it. I don't know if Director Graney has a different idea.
No. Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on House Bill 2180 while we're theoretically in work session on a different bill, but I'm interested if this issue can be dealt with in another bill that's coming to us, then it makes sense not to deal with it in this bill, which is really about a whole different set of things. So here's what I would like to do. I'd like to ask the vice chairs to work with me in a work group to see if we can boil the amendments down to one or two that we think the committee could settle on, and then bring the whole thing back to you and see if we can do it on Tuesday. So let's carry forward the work session on House Bill 2472 until Tuesday, and we'll close it now. We have a lot of work to do on Tuesday, but let's hope we can actually get some of these out.
And Mr. Chair, would you like for us to share...
Representative Call, please.
Would you like for us to share offline with you our thoughts on these?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
And I did ask you to respond to a questionnaire yesterday, so if you haven't done that, that would be helpful. If you have some additional thoughts, please get them to one of the three of us. So that we can have some sense of where we're going. And let's open the work session on House Bill 2014.
I'm betting three.
Yeah.
You're taking five.
Steve.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 2014, you should have a copy of the Dash 4 amendment that has all of the language changes in it, and I think pretty much replaces the original bill. This deals with the school construction taxes that were adopted last session. It requires that the collection of the construction taxes be by a government entity, including a state agency or official that issues permits for structural improvements. There's exemptions added for nonprofit long-term and residential care facilities and nonprofit continuing care retirement communities. The administrative collection fee is allowed to increase from 1% to 4% of tax revenue, and within that 4%, 1/4 of a percent tax revenue can be collected by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And that 1/4 of 1% only applies to the 09-11 biennium and then sunsets. It also clarifies that the collection is to be at the time the permit is issued. That increases the square footage, and it would take effect 91st day after adjournment. And it applies to construction taxes on or after the effective date.
And this is, if I recall, is the bill that essentially tells those who issue permits that they have to collect the money.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
And I was told that there was
Yes, there is. And let me say first that it's my understanding that Representative Hunt approves of the Dash 4 amendments. And I would like to hear from Gil Riddell, Mike Novak, and David Williams.
Mike Novak had to leave.
Oh, Mike had to leave. Okay. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. To the Dash 4 amendments to 2014, I think you got a nice little overview. I want to thank the Speaker's office for pulling the parties together and my colleagues at the League of Cities and the Association of Counties and the Building Codes Division for working to amicable solutions so that we can have a nice little technical fix to an otherwise great piece of legislation that came out of last session.
And for the record...
Thank you, Representative Riley. Yes, for the record, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Thank you very much. And just to not to beat up on any local governments, but lest anybody think there still isn't a problem with collections, In the Statesman Journal Friday, April 10th, a story about the Kaiser City Council formally taking a vote to oppose the construction excise tax for the Salem-Kaiser School District, which, as I'm told, is still several months away from actually adopting the tax. So I think it is important that we just reiterate that this is a school taxing authority, and the authority rests with the school districts and nobody else. Again, good amendment, good bill should pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. AOC agrees with the Dash 4 amendments, and we appreciate the work of the Speaker's Office and school boards and League of Cities and working cooperatively with us. We also appreciate this opportunity to round out the record, the legislative record. AOC believes in fostering and supporting local partnerships. In fact, 10 and soon 11 counties are collecting the school construction excise tax in spite of the fact that they're absorbing most of the administrative cost. Two counties were cited as resistant, and each has a story. The first county, a forest-dependent county, looked at the 1% cap on administrative fees and saw rightly that it was an underfunded mandate, and so was leery about that. The second county, we've addressed that with the 4% fee cap. The other county, Lynn, had planned a local economic stimulus plan by providing the building permits at no cost other than the $100 administrative fee. In fact, they've done that until the end of April. A new school construction excise tax would have negated that strategy. Local negotiations under the intergovernmental agreement between the school districts and the collecting authority have been very important and will continue to be very important in directly dealing with local issues that affect the collection costs and administration efficiency. Those items include designs of the CET within a one collection jurisdiction. If you have more than one design from various school districts collected by one jurisdiction, it complicates costs of administration and raises those costs. What to do about credit card fees and bounce checks. Startup costs, particularly of software programming, has to be changed. And identifying properties to which CETs apply, it's a challenge when there are multiple school districts in rural areas determining which property the particular CET applies. But we're glad to see this feature continue, and we support the Dash 4 amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Discussion, Representative Benz, did you have some questions?
Yes, sure, thank you. I'm interested in you guys' understanding of how the school district would negotiate with the collection entity, because the document dash four, page 2, line 16, says prior to collecting the construction tax, a school district shall enter into an agreement. So if the school district was interested in debating the amount of the expenses, I'm wondering who has the upper hand in those negotiations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, an excellent question. I think our goal would be to create a level playing field for discussion. I think as Mr. Riddell pointed out, there are quite a number of counties that have come to the table willingly and negotiated with their districts, and I'd rather not put it as an upper hand or a lower hand, if you will, just as an opportunity to have a solid discussion about an ability for our local government partners to be able to recoup the cost of administering this tax. This does make it clear that prior to collections occurring, that they do have to have an intergovernmental agreement in place with the city or the county or the state for collections. So I think it does to a degree, force the issue for the school district and require them to address the needs of their local government partners. But I don't think it's necessarily an upper hand or not. I think it's just incumbent on both parties to have a firm discussion about collections duties and responsibilities.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, we've kidded each other about which way the table is tipped, but it's a situation where you have to let local citizens and local partners work things out, and this provides the framework, and I think will be very productive.
Thank you, Representative Bence.
The 4% would appear to be the default rate when parties couldn't agree. But does that mean if a county still isn't willing to proceed, even with 4%, that they could say, we're not going to collect your taxes for you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, if they intend to violate the law, I think our assumption is that these folks who live in the same communities will operate in good faith.
And I will note, Representative, on page 1, lines 7 through 11, or 12, I think, address that issue. I don't know whether it's sufficient, but I think it's there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, I think we are confident that that language gives school districts an ability to remind any local governments that the responsibility for the local government is in negotiating over the collections, responsibilities, duties, and rates, not over whether or not the tax will take place in the first place.
Right. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, please.
I think my final question on page 3 of the dash 4, paragraph 3, the Department of Consumer and Business Services may establish by rule administrative fee of 0.25% of tax revenues, and I'm unclear on why that's here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, the Department of Consumer Business Services, they are the entity that issues building permits for those areas of the state, particularly Coos County and several others, that where the county is not the building permit issuance. And that's extemporaneous information that it's not why this is here. My understanding is the Department of Consumer Business Services is the entity that is developing the e-permitting system whereby counties and cities will be able to contract with them for, excellent. Representative from DCBS, I think I'll let them cover this.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Patrick Allen, Deputy Administrator of the Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The short story is last session in House Bill 2405, you directed us to go develop and deliver a world-class statewide online electronic building permit system, which we're in the midst of doing right now, and the first parts will be going live shortly. We frankly did not contemplate in the design of that system taxation issues like varying tax rates, parcels, the different issues we need to deal with for taxation. Right now, we're in the midst of trying to figure out if our world-class building permit system will be a minimally acceptable tax collection system, and we hope to be able to do that. If not, and we need to go make changes to that system, the 0.25% for 2 years allows us to be able to fund that additional element of what the system needs to be able to do.
Thank you. You're discovering the problem that the telephone company has been dealing with for 100 years. Different rates, different bases for taxes.
Oh, right. Yes, I got it.
Hundreds and hundreds of taxes that they have to deal with. Representative Bence.
Oh, sure. Thank you. So the 0.25% of tax revenues, I just wanted to know what tax revenues.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, that would be 0.25% out of the 4%. So it's out of the construction excise tax. It's a portion of the 4% that's allowed to be collected or allowed to be kept by the jurisdiction collecting the taxes.
Oh, the last three lines on page 2. Right.
Yes.
Other questions?
I had one.
Yes, please go ahead, Representative Bence.
The 4%. Where did the 4% come from,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Benz. During our discussions leading up to these Dash 4 amendments, I had conversations with the 11 counties that operate this, and the figure I heard most of all that would cover their expenses is 5%. That was not acceptable to the group, but they agreed to 4%.
It's a legislative compromise, Representative Benz.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you.
We don't have to accept it. It's up to us.
Yeah, it's a pretty dramatic change from the 1% that's in current
state. It certainly is, yes.
And Mr. Chair, let me emphasize that this has been reviewed by my board, and they accept it. They accept the Dash 4 amendments.
And you're the guy who's going to have to collect the money and incur the expense of collecting the money.
That's right, Mr. Chair. It's not a cheap collection process, and 1% does not come nearly close to covering the expenses. So.
Yeah. Representative Benz?
Yes, I was just, maybe you could explain what those expenses are so we understand.
Okay.
I understand on a small project, it could be a pretty small number. On a large project, it could be a pretty large number. Is that a correct understanding?
Yes, but the process is, as I understand it, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the county would, the contractor would come in and get the building permit and have to then pay the various fees, including the CET for the school districts. That has to be processed. It's processed either electronically or by hand. Many small counties, as I'm sure you're aware, do that by hand. Bookkeeping has to be kept, and then the money is transferred in separate accounts to the county treasurer. That process is he or she divides the amount into various accounts, makes sure that there's quarterly payments to the school districts. And the like, and there are expenses related to changing programming in those automated counties and other items. So it does take a little bit of time, and some of the as you point out, some of the CETs will be quite small, but on average the counties were comfortable enough with 4%.
Yep. And I guess that brings us back to the school districts, and I take it the school districts are comfortable with that's what you're testifying to.
Exactly. Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, we were comfortable with 4% as a way for our local governments, as a maximum of 4% as a way for our local governments to be able to recoup the costs that are confronting them.
And this truly is my final question.
Please, yes.
Thank you. So when you say you're comfortable with the maximum of, that would suggest that we go back to my question about how you would force the counties to take less. So how are you going to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I don't think our desire would be to force the counties to take any less than is necessary to cover the cost of their expenses, and I have no reason to believe that, by and large, the majority of counties and cities will come to the table with, here are our actual costs, and let's find a way to cover this. Our local government partners are not here to make a profit.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Springer.
Probably more of a comment than a question point, if you don't mind.
Yep.
Just to be very clear, as we're talking about fees again and increases in taxes, we're talking about a law that allows school boards to adopt the policy of a construction excise tax. It's their choice. If they choose to do that, and I know some districts are very afraid of that, some districts embrace that, and that's fine. Those districts that choose to do that then will be collecting that excise tax 1 to 5%, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, the tax itself is a maximum of $1 per square foot for new construction or 50 cents a square foot for non-residential construction.
Thank you for that.
The 4% is the amount of that dollar and 50 cents that the local government may retain for covering its administrative expenses for collections.
I just wanted to be very clear as we talked about this that, again, if the district chooses, then they will be paying. They will be losing some of that revenue because of the collection fee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, that's correct, except to say that I think that the expenses the district would incur and the loss The drop-off in collections, if they were to attempt to do the collections themselves, would be greater than the 4% for the nexus of the entity that issues the building permit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we need to be clear that we're not changing the amount of the tax that the school district is allowed to levy. We're simply requiring that the agency that collects the money for them has an option of keeping a slightly larger piece of it.
Correct.
That's what this bill essentially does. It also, if I recall correctly, exempts some more facilities from having to pay the tax: long-term care, residential, and continuing care retirement communities. That's on page 2, lines 7 through 9.
Correct, Mr. Chair, and those are designated as not-for-profit facilities.
Correct.
All of those.
Yes, thank you. Yes, yes. Lines 5 and 6. Thank you. That's right. But those are the two things that this bill does, as I understand it.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And of course, require that the building permit agencies actually collect the tax rather than allowing them to.
That's correct. The other subtle change that the bill does that I would like to point out is in the original legislation, let me find the line so I can reference it here. On page 2, lines 15 and 16, the original legislation required that prior to adopting a resolution, the district had to negotiate the intergovernmental agreement with the cities or the counties over collections. What we're doing is saying merely prior to collections, there was some concern that school districts would send off their superintendent or business manager to negotiate with a local entity and expend the time and effort to do so, and the board may not in the end have the political will to actually adopt the tax. So this puts that initial hurdle of the adoption of the tax at the board level at the front end, and then allows all of the technical negotiations to take place post that adoption.
Thank you. Does that clarify? Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? Representative Bailey, you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move the -4 amendment dated 4/10/2009 to House Bill 2014.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves the -4 amendment to House Bill 2014. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2014 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves House Bill 2014 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to that motion to move this bill to the floor? All right, I don't see any. The motion is adopted. Representative Hunt will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2014. I simply wanted to go over, before we adjourn, my agenda for this morning. Paul, I think that we have sent out, either to the floor or to another committee, House Bill 2970, House Bill 2014, and House Joint Resolution 7. Did we do that? Okay. And I think we have moved to Tuesday further work sessions on House Bill 2472, House Bill 2067, House Bill 2068, and House Bill 2105. Did I do all of that? All right. Thank you. With that, the committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brain dead.